Welcome to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. We live in an age where science has answered so many big questions that many struggle to reconcile faith and science. Our next guest says when we study science, it's not an absolute truth, just within the parameters of that experiment. When people make science the absolute ideal for all truth, they miss out on the broader idea of what it means to have something be true. Faith is rooted in the internal core of who we are as human beings. There is a reason we keep coming back to faith and religion. In the Moment continues our conversations about the future of faith in South Dakota today with George Tsakarides. He is a lecturer in philosophy and religion in the School of American and Global Studies at South Dakota State University. He joined us from the Janine Basinger Studio at SDSU.
Hi, I am very happy to be here.
All right, so let's get started with just a little bit about where your interest is. How did you end up kind of following this idea of, you know, the intersection between, you know, science and faith, faith and pop culture, some of the things that you find interesting? What drew you to them?
Well, I think the honest answer is, you know, when you're a kid, you have a lot of different interests, and then you have to choose a career path. And as I chose a career path, I kind of just decided I'm going to include all of those things that I want to do. And so I was always interested in science. I wanted to be a scientist. My undergraduate degree is in electrical engineering. And somewhere along the way, I decided through various means that I wanted to go into theology and religion. And so I started down that path, but realized that I still liked science and I wanted to study it. So that intersection of religion and science, which was an active category in the scholarship, was a really viable option there.
All right. So, I'm going to jump in here because I also want to let listeners know that you're an actor, you have a podcast, you are involved in a lot of different things. And for some of us who are interested in so many different things, somebody's going to say, how do you have time, you know, how do you decide that day, what is the area that I'm going to follow? How do you make all these different parts of your personality and your personhood sort of find their expression in their life? So talk a little bit about that, if you would. I'd love to hear your thoughts on that.
That is a great question that I struggle with regularly, to be honest, because it does take a lot of time. And the more successful you become in one area, the more time it ends up taking, as you probably know. And I'm reaching some of that critical mass at times. But I schedule my time in such a way that, you know, I mean, I work a job at SDSU and I work on my scholarship. I work on my teaching. But, you know, some people go home and just watch TV or veg out. And sometimes I do that plenty, let me say. But at the same time, I also spend some of my off time or a weekend working on, you know, my creative work. And I've gotten plugged into a great network of independent filmmakers here in South Dakota and elsewhere in the country. And you just start to meet people who are passionate about the same things you are, and you work with them, and you build friendships. And my approach to networking is that I just try and make friends with people. And if it leads to work, that's great. But if not, then I made a great friendship. And that tends to be successful, and it really builds kind of an authentic relationship with people, and that leads to great work.
As an educator, then, you mentioned, you know, your undergraduate work in engineering and then transferring to this, you know, sort of what might have seemed to family members and friends as this completely divergent path. And now that you have students coming through, I'm sure some of them are rethinking, you know, why they ended up, you know, declaring a certain major. How do you sort of help people walk through the fact that it's okay to do the next thing that you're curious about?
Well, I think this is an issue of identity ultimately, and I do some different work and think about identity quite a bit in religion and philosophy. And I think the paradigm is changing with the current generation where, you know, in previous generations we were very tied to our job and you were defined by your job. And due to economic factors and other social factors, we're now in a position where you can kind of define yourself based on your interests and your character and other things, and you're not just your job, to quote Fight Club, I guess, there. and I think that younger people are seeing that, and they're more willing to take a chance or be an entrepreneur or, you know, follow one career field, but then be an actor or a musician or something on the side that they can really be passionate about. And it makes them a better person overall. because they're not one-dimensional.
And so then let's pivot to there being a time in generations past where you were identified by your faith or by your faith home, by the church that you went to. That was the epicenter of everything. And as time, I mean, where you ate dinner on a Wednesday night to where you got married to, you know, who you married, all these things were part of that, your identity, and that has shifted as well.
Yeah, significantly. And I think that's really touches on the divide we see in the present day between the idea of religion and spirituality.
Yeah.
That many people have rejected that idea of religion that is kind of structured and socially based. And it's, in some ways, I think many people have seen the hypocrisy of just doing or professing a faith that they don't necessarily hold to because that's the social standard and necessary for social means. And instead, kind of exploring spirituality and personal faith, and in fact, I'd say the current generation may even be more spiritual than past generations. They just aren't in those structures anymore.
Hmm. And how are scientific advances sort of folding into that and changing, you know, the way that we contemplate the universe, the way that we contemplate our own emotions as we learn about brain science, for example? How is science changing how we see our faith?
Well, there's a lot of directions I can go with this, so I'll choose one, and we can work through it. But this is almost unlimited.
Yeah.
I think to touch on what you opened the segment with, science. People have looked at science as kind of the be-all, end-all of truth, and I believe science is true. It is great. I love science. Hopefully, that's apparent from my history. But at the same time, it is set up hypotheses and observation, and it tells us what it's supposed to tell us. It tells us truth within a certain paradigm. So it isn't that it is not true, but it doesn't take into account everything in the universe. It only takes into account the natural order and certain experimental results. And even science is contingent, I always say. So it would be boring if it wasn't, because we have to keep trying new things, discovering new things. When we discovered quantum physics, or I should say, you know, maybe Albert Einstein did it, not me. But when it was discovered, that totally changed the paradigm of the natural order. And it wasn't that everything before it was false. We still study Newtonian physics. But it now was set in a different kind of framework. And so that framework is constantly changing. And so it's, I think, I hate to use the word, but arrogant to say that science has discovered everything. Even scientists are still working through things. Religion and spirituality has always been with humans, and that is something that really touches on what it means to be human and who we are. And that works with science, but it doesn't have to work against science.
Right, because sometimes when it works against science, you have this sense of, the things that we couldn't explain were the things that, we attributed to, we being human beings, attributed to, some divine order. And then when we learned that we could explain it in some, we understood the science better, that divine order gets smaller and smaller to the things that we can't explain. And I was listening one time to a news story about, they were talking about the God of the gaps, where if you just put God in the gap of knowledge, then when that knowledge fills in, your God was pretty small, it turns out. And that's not necessarily a useful way to compartmentalize science and our notion of God.
That's exactly right. And the idea of the God of the gaps, if science will continue to progress, so if your God is only the God of the gaps, those gaps will get smaller and smaller. And, to use a mathematical term, it's like a limit equation that goes to zero.
Yeah.
And so many people do see God that way. They say, well, science has eradicated the idea of God because it will and has explained everything. And I think we need to look at just life and the universe more holistically. And I don't mean that in like a New Age way, but that science is a part of that. And it tells us a lot, but it doesn't tell us the whole story. And I think, to get back to the original question, the difference between religion and spirituality, for many, they've seen hypocrisy in religious systems, just personally and scientifically, as religion tried to converge with the scientific truth. And that was a mistake because it leads to the God of the gaps.
Hmm.
And so I think spirituality, though, allows people to explore their own personhood in ways that are more broad. And I think that actually can lead back to traditional ideas of religion. It's just that right now we're going through that kind of transition.
Right. Let's talk a little bit about why people, return to faith, why human beings have a tendency to leave and sort of dismantle or deconstruct things brick by brick. And then when that deconstruction is done, have a tendency to build something else or not. Very broadly, let's start with this idea of people coming back to faith and religion after an absence.
Well, like when I teach philosophy here at SDSU, I tell the students, I'm not trying to change your beliefs, but what I want you to do is, and I wouldn't say it exactly like this, but deconstruct your beliefs, look at them critically, and if you find you have the same beliefs, then now you have a more reasoned belief system and you can be more confident in it. And if you change, well, maybe those beliefs needed to be changed. Maybe there was a problem you were ignoring. And so I think when people deconstruct their belief systems, it should lead to a stronger faith if that faith is rooted in something substantive. So, I always have approached religion that if my own personal faith is true, then it's going to hold up to scrutiny. And if it's not, then there's probably a problem with it to begin with.
And then there are people. So this is, we're having a conversation that is fairly thoughtful and I would even say intellectual. And there are other people that I know who are like, I can't articulate my faith. I can't tell you, I can't quote everything that you would need to know to defend this to someone who doesn't believe. And they're feeling that tension of just, believing something and knowing something, but not being able to explain that.
So what I would tell people is, and this is where I think science goes wrong. When you apply scientific methods to other aspects of life, it tends to create this very literal, modernistic viewpoint where people are afraid to express their faith because they don't have an answer for everything. And honestly, they shouldn't, because there aren't answers for everything that we have. But to go back to like an idea of... to reference a philosopher, William James, and this is an American idea, that we're very pragmatic here, and experience matters. And so people can always share their experience. I can't invalidate your experience. I could choose not to believe it, but I can't say that your faith is false because of these scientific reasons. You've experienced it. And so to you, that has a truth. And so I think people should start there and be willing to share their own experience and their own beliefs based on who they are versus trying to conform to a scientific method that they really wouldn't have hope of living up to unless they've had years of training.
Yeah. Or a religious dogma? Are there parallels there?
Religious dogma, I think there are parallels because religious dogma still is at times a crude way to describe what is indescribable. And even if you look at, let's say, the history of Christianity, there are all these councils and creeds and attempts to explain who God is, and people recite those, and I think they're very valuable, but at the same time, language is still an approximation of what reality is, which sounds really philosophical, I know.
But, and yet it sounds very true. Doesn't it sort of resonate as truth? Yeah.
Yeah, I hope so.
Yeah. I want to go back to this idea of spirituality versus, religion. And when we talk about the future of faith in South Dakota, more and more people, as a nation, we're becoming less Christian, in quotation marks, from Pew Religious Forum research.
Yes.
That fewer and fewer people are identifying with a certain faith, and there's a lot more of the nuns, N-O-N-E, as in people who have no religion or no particular affiliation. That seems to be growing, but yet we also often hear people talking about their spirituality or their sense of wonder, their search for meaning. Do you think we're in a particular time in history? Is this something that has really always been going on? Are we on a wave of something? What are some of your initial thoughts on that?
Well, I do think we're on a wave of something, and history does, ebb and flow with religious traditions. I mean, there's a long history of that. But I think the fact that people are drawn to spirituality, I would ask them, you know, why that is. It's pointing to something about the human experience or perhaps the divine experience that they can't quite put their finger on, but they want to explore. And they've found traditional religion to be lacking in explaining that. And so I think part of it is that traditional religions have failed many of the current generations that are around, you know, the millennials, Generation Z, et cetera. But at the same time, I think people will slowly move back to religion because they do crave that structure and that spirituality. And exploring it on one's own can only go so far, I think. I think we are drawn to structure. I think there's research that would show that.
Right.
Although it gets pretty complex.
Yeah. Do you think it will look significantly different than it does? You know, when we say they'll come back, are we thinking they'll come back to the same buildings and, order of worship?
No, I think things will change for sure, and they are changing. We see in American Protestantism a high degree of, you know, divides and separations and people leaving the church. So in mainline Protestant denominations, they're, you know, quote, dying off because young people are not staying in the church. And I think that is because they have found the structures and the experience to be lacking. And, I mean, I see a lot of, I mean, people always blame the church for hypocrisy, and I think there is a degree of that there. And I think as generations kind of grow and look to the future, they will come back, but they will hopefully correct some of the hypocrisies of the past. And what I tend to tell people about religion and structured religion is when you tie ideas of faith to power, that creates big problems. And I think we see that history in some major religious traditions, and most notably in the West, the Roman Catholic Church. When the papacy had a lot of state power, that created huge issues for Europe and the world. And I think that this sounds very American, I guess, but in many ways, religion, it should be democratic. It should be something that people can choose and experience on their own within those kind of guidelines and structures.
That's fascinating. And one of the other things as we have these conversations that I have been hearing again and again is how many faith leaders, faithful people, people who identify as Christian, have been coming in and wanting to talk about their faith as a way to speak up against how faith is being used as a power play in politics today. So, for example, you know, you have these more liberal-leaning Christians who are saying this, you know, I'm painting with a broad brush when I say liberal and conservative, but, you know, this conservative legislation, for example, which is being argued from this viewpoint of, you know, this is the godly thing to do, or this is, a faith-based initiative. That's not our faith. That's not our Jesus. That's not. And it seems like more and more people want to talk about their faith openly, at least on this program, as a way to say, to sort of remove some of that power as well. Faith and power is a really interesting thing to think about.
Yes, definitely. And I think one of the issues we have in America right now is that people have become so tied to their political affiliations that it actually has kind of superseded their religious beliefs at times. And we see these kind of hypocrisies on both the right and the left. And I think that I'd like to think, and I think we do see the, like, Generation Z, the younger generation coming up and seeing that hypocrisy and reacting to it. And that's typically what happens through history is the next generation reacts to the previous one and then, you know, corrects some things, but maybe swings too far the other way on other things.
Right. Sometimes it seems like Generation X just had nothing to say. Like, what happened to Gen X?
Is this a proud member of Gen X.
Yeah, me too. I'm like, where do we go wrong? Like, it's straight from boomers to millennials, and did we just completely drop the ball on everything? We checked out a little too much, George? I don't know.
I think we fell into a little, I'd like to think of it positively.
All right, help
that,
me.
Yeah, the boomers, you know, had, many of the millennials were born of boomers, although Gen X was too, in large part. And the millennials had it, you know, the bad, let's say the crude narrative is that the millennials had it good and the boomers gave them everything and spoiled them. But at the same time, the boomers messed up the political system and ruined their future. That's kind of the bad narrative that is out there right now. Whereas Gen X kind of experienced the old ways of the boomers and the greatest generation, and yet they had some of the technologies and the good life of the millennials. And so we kind of fell in the middle and had this nice little pocket. And what it does for me is it finds me longing for, you know, my childhood. Yeah. And I mean, I'm writing a book right now on theology and the Americans, the TV show The Americans,
okay,
which is set in the 1980s, and it's Soviet sleeper spies. And I just watch it.
Sure.
I mean,
yeah.
Nostalgically.
I haven't seen that yet, but yeah, I want to see that. Yeah,
highly recommend it.
Let's talk a little bit about this pop culture and theology sort of intersection and why that's interesting to you.
Well, I think I can give you like personal. The personal answer is partly what I just said. I watch television, I watch movies, and I see things that move me, and I think. As an actor and filmmaker and just as a human being, I am moved more by that sort of media than by academic discourse. And I think most people are. And I think that's a more powerful way to share your message. And so in part, I like doing religion and pop culture because it's a way to share these deeper messages through the media of the day. And people can then accept ideas without having to read dry academic arguments. And I think that's something academia has done very poorly throughout the years. Mm. But at the same time, it's a chance to just really enjoy and like write a book on something I like. So right now I'm also editing a volume on theology and Spider-Man.
Nice.
And it's just fun. I mean, I have a bunch of contributors who, you know, like Spider-Man, and they're thinking about deep theological issues of like sin and reconciliation, liberation theology, identity. Just all these different ideas are coming up in this fun cartoon and movie set that everyone enjoys.
Yeah.
And so that both helps the culture, I think, by working through it, but it also kind of feeds our inner child and our creative streak, and some really fun stuff comes out of it.
All right, and that brings us back to this idea that humans keep coming back to faith and religion in the sense that we can't even just chill out to Spider-Man without, you know, without looking at the deeper meaning and what it says about life. I mean, we're not necessarily just vegging out and consuming. Some days we are, but often
yes.
We're not just consuming media, consuming books, movies, comic books, you know, blogs, podcasts. We're using that to inform the sort of living philosophy and theology that we are continuing to develop in the world.
Yeah, I think that's very true. And we're drawn to certain television shows or movies or ideas partially for entertainment reasons, but partially because it makes us think and it mirrors our own experience. And where I think media of any sort, it could be a book or a movie or a television show or a piece of art, we're really looking to see ourselves in that art. And so when we're drawn to art that kind of mirrors our experience, it helps us understand ourselves better because it's putting something into, I don't want to say into words, into visuals or into an experience that we can't always explain. And when we do that, it's very powerful. That's why art through history is powerful. And faith and art and religion and art are very tied together. Despite the fact that sometimes people try and separate those things.
Right. I was going to say, who has more power, the politics, the religious leaders, or the artists? But that's separation right there, isn't it?
It is.
Yeah, the nature of that question is flawed.
Yeah, and it's tricky. And I think that's why being, kind of a Renaissance person is important. I think it's important to do all these things that you love and are important to you, because it's expressing your holistic self. It's not just saying, well, I'm an academic, so I'm supposed to sit in an office for 12 hours and read books.
Yeah.
Which is great if that's what you love to do, and many people do. But I think it's good to balance that out in various ways. And I think people are more thoughtful than we sometimes give them credit for when they watch television
yeah.
or consume media.
Yeah. Is that maybe why, does that sort of help us understand why people get so upset when an actor, you know, speaks out politically? When, you know, Robert De Niro speaks out about President Trump and they say, you know, you're an actor, you know, stay in your lane, or, you know, a football player makes a political statement, or an athlete makes a political statement, that we have, that some people have this natural notion that people should be compartmentalized into one thing or another. But in fact, you know, we're citizens, we're human beings, you know, we are creatures kind of walking around trying to figure out how to be in the world.
Yeah, I think that is accurate. And I think part of it is, let's say if Robert De Niro is portraying a character that you love and you see yourself in, and then he does something in his real self that is totally different than what you would do, you don't know how to maybe place that, because that character that you've attached to now has done something you cannot attach to. And that's something actually I'm just thinking now, but would love to explore that more. Yeah, I think there's more to that.
Right, and that goes to why people, you know, anyone, Jesus of Nazareth, going back and saying he would do this, but would I do that? You know, how people were off, you know, arguing on the floor of the state legislature about what would Jesus do in this situation, and people had very different answers about what the same person would do, and had their scriptural evidence for why they felt that way. There's something there to explore. Yeah,
that goes down another rabbit hole. I mean, people tend with scriptures of any sort, but especially the Christian Bible in an American context, they tend to put priority over some texts over others.
Right.
And so when the text that you like is what matters to you, then you will kind of tout that, even though it maybe disagrees with a different text, and then you have these sorts of arguments.
Which is why some people are, you know, want to throw the whole bag in the garbage, whether they say, you know, everyone in Washington is corrupt, I'm not interested in politics, I'm done, or they say, I'm going to leave the church behind because I just can't handle, you know, this hypocrisy and this damage that you know, the church that I've been attending is doing in the world. And then you walk away, but you can't really, can you walk away? Can you walk away, or do you end up trying to seek meaning? Is there a good way to walk away and seek meaning in some other way?
Wow, that's a great question. I think there are probably many ways to do that. I mean, some people think change from within is best, to stay in the political structure or in the church and work to change it.
Yeah.
Others sometimes think a clean break is best and to reset in another way, in another place. But I think what's tough is, especially with faith and religion, is if something is tied very deeply to your identity from a young age, and you find it to be lacking later, you find it to be hypocritical, you're kind of fighting with yourself at that point. And so even though you know that maybe I should leave or maybe I should change something, you would have to admit that you were wrong or that there's something flawed in your upbringing. And many people have trouble doing that.
Yeah.
And I think probably all of us have trouble doing it, and some are more successful than others.
Have you seen Jojo Rabbit, the movie? Yet.
I have not.
Have
not yet.
So this is a 10-year-old Nazi, and of course, you know, coming of age and realizing, and it sort of expresses just what you were saying. And there's the scene in the movie. I don't want to spoil the ending, but it's historic, so we kind of know how it ends, and that the Nazis are not going to stay in power. And there's a scene where he's just so conflicted, and he'd put these, you know, flyers up, you know, so this pro-Nazi propaganda up in town, and the city is under siege, and he's walking around trying to put the flyers back up, even though he's already kind of, you know, rejected Nazism. Mm-hmm. But there is this conflict, and this 10-year-old said, I cared so lovingly about this, and I managed it, I maintained it. It was my work, it was what I was living for, and now it's falling apart. And you just sort of watch this whole thing crumble and deconstruct around them. And there's people who are kind and people who are cruel. And it's a brilliant, brilliant film that sort of explores some of the things that we've been talking about.
Yeah, I think that really touches on what we were just talking about and how people experience film, too. You may not be able to admit to yourself the kind of the flaws or the damage that has been done to you in your life. But watching it through a piece of art, it helps to register that in a more personal, internal way, because it's not you being attacked.
Right.
Someone else is being attacked. And through that attack on them, hopefully in a fictional sense, you then see the kind of the what is lacking in your own life. And yeah. and so that's why movies move us so deeply.
That's so smart.
Yeah.
That's well, so thank smart. You. And the other thing about that movie is that it's really funny. You know, it's a comedy. And then at the end, this is my personal experience. I knew it was going to be sad. I had read some spoilers accidentally. And I went home. I could not stop crying. And I was like, I think it had something to do with the laughter, the fact that how many times yes. that I sort of laughed uncomfortably and was primed emotionally to see these things were funny. I cried a little bit in the theater, and then I got in the car and I couldn't stop. And I was like, what has this filmmaker done to me emotionally? How did he put me in that space to where all this emotion is just pouring out all at once? Mm-hmm. It's really kind of a brilliant crafting of a film that really, you know, is pretty accessible. As a film, a lot of people would probably see it. It's not very academic.
Well, the best films, I think, are layered where, you know, there's a deeper meaning, but it's very accessible to everybody.
Yeah.
And I think the idea of laughter and sadness or crying being tied together is on the nose. I mean, that's correct. And we laugh at things sometimes because they do annoy us, or they make us sad, or they're incomprehensible otherwise, but we can laugh at them, and it helps to break that tension.
Yeah.
And I mean, I remember, I don't know if I should give the example, but I was watching a movie when I was in college, and there was a very violent scene in this movie.
Yeah.
And I actually laughed. And the reason I laughed is so I wouldn't cry.
Mm-hmm.
Because there has to be some emotional utterance, and it also comes back to, you know, we're very emotional beings, and asking that question, what does it mean to be human? And art and science and all of these categories tap into that in different ways, and we should see the complexity of how that works, and not try and just say science has the full truth, yeah. or even art has the full truth. We have a very robust, you know, whole palette of colors to paint from, and we should, you know, enjoy all of them.
Yeah. I want to talk about your podcast, because when we talk about things that are accessible and funny, the television show Cheers, and I haven't listened yes. to this yet because I was looking at it and I was thinking, I had that moment where you look at something and you think, what is this? And then you come back to it and you say, now that's interesting. And I think now I'll go back and I'll listen. But tell us a little bit about this podcast, please.
Okay, so it's called Cheers Weekly.
Okay.
And we're on Facebook and Twitter. The Twitter handle's Cheers Weekly Pod. And we're on iTunes, so that's all my advertising. But a friend of mine, Randy Woodbury, and I, we've known each other since freshman year of college.
Mm-hmm.
So more years than I want to admit on air. but a long time. And a few years back, we were talking about doing a podcast, and we both love Cheers. And no one had done a full Cheers podcast yet. And now there are a couple others that have followed us. But we're on episode, I think, 110. And it's, you know, 30 to 40 minutes. Usually we talk about what we're watching on television and movies. We do some 80s nostalgia.
Uh-huh.
And actually part of the reason I'm doing it, or at least what has come out of it, is I'm able to relive experiences as a child and a teenager through this podcast, and it brings back emotions and feelings that I hadn't even thought about for a while.
All right, give me an example.
Oh man. Okay, yeah. So there's a lot of references on the show for me to WGN TV, because I grew up in the heart of Chicago. I grew up a little south of Wrigley Field, and it was in the 80s when Harry Carey, you know, was announcing for the Cubs and the whole thing. So the old commercials, just for Cheers and watching Cheers, it just, I can't put this quite into words, but it brings this inner emotion, and it's something that you know, an experience that you're tapping back into, and it's watching like on WGN in my living room. It's a second, you know, story of a two flat in Chicago, half a block from the L train, and you know, the sunlight's coming in, and I'm sitting there on the couch or the floor with my brother watching, you know, one of these sitcoms.
Yeah.
And it brings me back to that moment. The sitcom brings me back to an actual experience. And that's art and music is very powerful because of that. It brings us back to experiences and moments, and also sometimes maybe not so pleasant ones.
Yeah. So in music therapy, when we did a story on that, they really talked about a music therapist going into a nursing home, even working with dementia patients, and kind of finding out how old they were, and then trying to parse out, like, what would the music have been that was popular when they were 13? And not everybody likes the same things, of course, and that will get harder as more music, floods. For, a Gen Z person is going to have way more access than somebody, who grew up in the 40s. But yes. When they find that music that happens to trigger that memory, how people will just completely come out of, in some cases, the room that they were locked into. And it's because bringing yes. you right back into that space of when you were. And something about that age of 13 seems to be incredibly important. Mm. I kind of wish I'd watched more TV when I was that, At the time, I didn't think that I thought it was good not to watch too much TV. But now I'm like, I don't remember any of those shows from when I was that age. I didn't watch TV then.
I watched way too much TV, and I wish I'd watched a little less. But I mean, like right now, if in my office the last few days, I've been listening, to Belinda Carlisle on
right.
YouTube. And it's like, that's right in that era when I was, 13 to 15.
Yeah.
And a little younger, the Go-Go's and, mm-hmm. like, I listen to Heaven is a Place on Earth by Belinda Carlisle, and it brings me back to somewhere. It just makes me feel good.
Yeah.
And music has that power. And I think that that's why we don't want to relegate art when we're talking about science. I mean, people go down a scientific path sometimes, and they forget that art is what brings that experience. And we aren't just, a mind in a jar.
Mm. And likewise, then, would you say we don't want to separate art from faith in the sense that, because I think there are some faith traditions that really question or challenge, should you be listening to what kind of music should be? It should be praise music. It should be music that, puts you in a certain space. What's lost when we sort of put a big wall up and say the only art that comes in is art that specifically targets a certain part of my life, which is, my religious life?
Well, I would both affirm and challenge that. So I think it is important to affirm that, like, the type of music we listen to does affect us. Mm-hmm. And so if you're listening to something that is not helpful for you, maybe you should back off of that. Or the same with television shows. People will watch maybe extremely violent television shows and then wonder why they're anxious.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that does have an effect on us. We are human. We experience that in some way. But at the same time, we should open ourselves up to a range of music and a range of television, a range of art, so that we can experience that full, palette of human experience.
Mm. George, this has been delightful for me. I don't know if you planned to spend this much time with us when you came in the studio today, and we certainly hit a lot of ideas that we could explore further in the future.
I'd be happy to do that.
So you are welcome back anytime.
Awesome.
George, thank you so much. We appreciate your time.
Thank you for having me.